Hello, and welcome to this PERspectives Continuing Education Podcast, created by healthcare professionals for healthcare professionals. PER is a leader in healthcare education and offers free accredited medical education programs in a variety of accessible formats at gotoper.com. Today's podcast features highlights from a symposium on meibomian gland dysfunction at the American Optometry Association meeting in San Diego. First up is the chair of the program, Dr. Kelly Nichols, with a look at the many threats to these underappreciated glands.
So dry and MGD, of course, it's near and dear to my heart. Maybe it's near and dear to your heart as well. Quite a few years ago, optometrists and ophthalmologists were surveyed about how common it was to see patients with MGD, and found that MGD was the most common cause of evaporative dry eye. And that probably is something you've heard before. It's something, a phrase that's been going around for a long time, but not necessarily do we do a very good job of looking for it. How many of you in the room, and I want you to raise your hands, press on the glands routinely? Excellent. I'm telling you, that's really great, because I'd say 5 years ago, not so many raising of the hand. So you're doing a great job, and hopefully you'll do even more after tonight's lecture. Those meibomian glands here in this image are what they're supposed to look like. Well, it's a graphic of what they're supposed to look like. You have 20 to 30 or so on the top and about that many on the bottom. They're supposed to be, you know, very linear and straight and kind of follow the tarsus and the tarsal plate. When they get blocked, and it'll be important to think about this as we're learning a bit more about these medications that are on the horizon, when they get blocked at the top, it's sort of like a water balloon. Pressure from the inside pushes out, and then from the distal or bottom, they start to die. So that continues. So if we can do things to keep the opening open, if we can do things to clean off the top of the opening, perhaps change things to the lid margin a little bit, or just warm up what's in there so it comes out better, we can start to address the key pathophysiology of MGD. So most of the time MGD is because there's a blockage. There can be also associated with that irregularity in the quantity or the quality of the meibum that's secreted. And you don't know necessarily about all the elements of quality. When you press and you see yucky white stuff, well, certainly you know that quality is bad. But sometimes it can be clear and still be wrong because it's being made incorrectly. So we are learning more and more about the meibum, but it can be either of those two things that's incorrect, causing MGD. That then results in symptoms, subsequent inflammation, and dry eye. And it's a vicious cycle. That cycle goes around and around. That sort of dry eye disease, some of the things related to that, like increased osmolarity, inflammation, keratinization, changes to the ocular surface. There's lots of things that impact MGD, but they're all related. So microbes, lipase changes, increased melting point temperature of the meibum and all of that. So you can't separate one from the other. It really truly is a vicious cycle. Most importantly, as you know, your patients have symptoms and they tell you that it irritates them. Their fluctuating vision might cause changes in their quality of life. They can't use their devices as long as they want to comfortably. There's a lot of risk factors for MGD, many of which you have seen many times. A couple I want to point out as a reminder, certainly there's a lot of talk about Demodex and how that impacts MGD, and you're going to be hearing a lot more about Demodex in the upcoming months. I want to remind you about rosacea. Certainly that's a very important thing that we often forget to look at or manage. And then I also like to remind people about Sjogren's syndrome. If you have a patient that has decreased aqueous production, they often have MGD associated with it as well. And so don't overlook them. I mean, they really appreciate the diagnosis when they finally get it. And it's often because an optometrist took the time to investigate.
Later in the program, the conversation turned to investigational therapies for MGD that are in the pipeline. First up, Dr. Mark Blumenstein discusses Novo-3 with Dr. Selena McGee, followed by another agent, AZR-MD-001.
So one of the things that I think we haven't really lost sight of, but I think everybody sitting here realizes this is an evaporative disease. And part of the reason, you know, when we know that the meibum basically acts kind of, when I'll tell patients, it's like the saran wrap on your plate of cookies. You don't have that there, the cookies are going to turn to crap. Your wife's going to blame you, say, why did the cookies, you did it. I'm like, no, I didn't. I've heard other people say it's like a roof on a house. I mean, the bottom line here is that as this evaporates, it desiccates, it causes more problems. Novo 3 is a unique compound. This is essentially a, it's, I don't think there's anything out there. It's water free. It's, there's no preservative because it's one molecule. It's perfluorohexyl octane. And when I say that, this is going to be something completely different for all of us because your patients put it in their eye and that's what it does. It basically spreads out throughout the cornea and stabilizes the tears that they have there. The data has been shown that it increases both the total corneal fluorescein staining after 57 days. And moreover, it's, oh, see, I did it again. It has also shown that it improved visual acuity scores where patients felt they were seeing better. So within that 57 days and 2 months, patients are seeing improvement in both signs and symptoms. So I'm excited about something that's going to be 4 times a day for patients. But more importantly, it's been shown that the contact time on this is about 240 hours or something ridiculous like that. So if we can stabilize that, the other thing that you have to know about this molecule is that it resides, they've shown some PK studies that it resides in the meibomian glands. So there's some ambiguity as to what it's doing in the meibomian glands, but it's stabilizing the cornea and basically hoping to kind of decrease the evaporation.
Just one key point I think that's really important is I love their clinical endpoint is corneal staining and how that relates to visual acuity, because I think that sometimes we can easily miss that, especially if we're not doing staining consistently with patients. But when they have fluctuating vision, they're not going to see well when they have corneal staining. And so this is a really key piece of, I think, the study that's different than most of our dry eye studies that do Schirmer's.
I think maybe next year, hopefully we'll see this in our armamentarium. There's another one that's coming out of Australia. And you heard us talk about the junk or the stuff that builds up on the meibomian glands orifices. It's mainly keratin. I mean, for a large portion of it's keratin, which is essentially, if you think of these as hairless follicles, the meibomian glands, they're secreting keratin. And keratin basically is through disulfide bonds. And the more disulfide bonds are, the harder it gets. What this molecule is doing is AZRMD001 is breaking down the keratin. It breaks the disulfide bonds just like selenium. I mean, for anybody here that used like Celsum Blue for dandruff, it's a very similar kind of compound. And what they've been able to show, and they have different concentrations that they're looking in their study, they're looking at meibomian gland yield to see how it's much is coming out. But one of the things that they're really doing is they're evaluating the free-flowing sulfide bonds. So if you break a sulfide, it attaches to an oxygen, and they count those up. And one of the things they found in their clinical study is that the higher concentration in these has definitely shown improvement in these meibomian gland yields. They're producing better. And so this is kind of exciting. They're starting their phase 3 clinical trials, I think, literally like in January, and they're going to be coming here. So the only drawback to this, I mean, the only effect, side effect, has been a little bit of instillation discomfort. So this should be pretty exciting, too.
Yeah, it does have some burning on the lid margin, reportedly. And they have done a number of phase 2 trials trying to sort through what it does and how often they should use it and what concentration. So we'll be seeing more as they start the phase 3 trials, which do say take some time. So this one's a bit further out. I wouldn't expect any good results or hear good results until 2024. Okay. But again, I think that burning of the lid margin, because it is an installation on the lid margin, it's not intended to be used. It's going to be maybe once or twice a week. So it's not going to be, right?
Yeah, they also talked about maybe making it an in-office treatment. So they were looking at a much higher concentration where you actually do it in the office. So it'll be interesting to see how it works.
But this is pretty exciting because it actually is breaking that keratin or that gunk on the lid margin. And MGD patients are shown in some studies that we've done before to actually have like 13 or 14 different kinds of keratins that are upregulated on the lid margin. So good news there. I have a question for our group here. What's your favorite thing that you've like sort of incorporated into your office flow related to dry eye or MGD that you think makes the most difference to your patients?
I screen every single patient for dry eye and MGD. So when they come in for their comprehensive exam, they all fill out the same exact questionnaire, and it has dry eye related questions, rosacea questions. But that questionnaire, to every single patient creates awareness. It uncovers lots of things that they wouldn't bring up during the eye exam. That has been my key piece to all of the technology that we have, is asking those questions every single time consistently.
And that's on, I mean, you don't have just a dry, do you have just dry practice, or do you have your regular
everything? Oh no, so I have a primary eye care practice. Good. And I am my biggest referral to my dry eye center.
Question in the middle first.
So her question is, what age do I start the survey? Actually, we start it in their teens. And the reason why is that great study that Kelly put up earlier, where it showed over the lifetime of the patient what's happening with their meibomian glands and how they change. And it seems to flatline with aqueous deficiency around their 40s. But what we know is we start to see meibomian gland changes in their teens. And especially there was a couple of papers done looking at teenagers through the pandemic because there's so much screen time. And in that paper, ages 3 to 19, they had already lost in some of those kiddos 20% of their meibomian glands. So I think it's really key to talk about it early and often and screen for that early and often. So we actually started at 12, but we're having conversations with our patients about visual hygiene, making sure that they take breaks. And I mean, there's multiple reasons for that, not just MGD and dry. It's also about good practices and preventing and slowing down myopia and all of those pieces too. So that's the age that we start.
After the live program, Dr. Nichols visited PER to discuss particular aspects of MGD management. Here are her thoughts on MGD risk factors, followed by insight on performing gland expression and using those results to rate the patient's MGD severity.
There are several risk factors for MGD, including there can be medication use, digital device use, even age, although some studies show that, well, you normally would think that dry eye or even evaporative dry might be more related to women and women as they age. Some studies have shown MGD or MGD alone might be more common in men. So I'd say the jury is out as to who gets it more. We are seeing that MGD does increase across age. So certainly if you have a patient that's complaining of some symptoms and is, you know, getting a few more years on them, then it is worth looking to see the quality of their meibom secretions. Sometimes MGD patients don't overtly say that their eyes feel bad, so they won't bring up symptoms. You might express a gland and then see something, and then that actually points you to the fact that their meibom is irregular. You might find a reduced tear film breakup time or something like that is what triggers you to maybe look at the meibomian glands. I find, though, that if you start asking the questions and probing a little bit about how they use their eyes, their digital device use, if they're taking medications, those sorts of things, if they have systemic diseases like rosacea, all those things are sort of, you know, real easy red herrings that might be worth considering. Well, certainly would be worth considering expressing the meibomian glands. And if you have the opportunity to do meibography, taking a look at the sort of anatomical structures that are there and how healthy those look. So those sort of all tie in together relative to the symptoms, though. And I find these days that digital device use and tiredness of the eyes toward the end of the day, or transient blurry vision when people are using devices towards the end of the day or even watching TV, are signs that are basically symptoms that should be evaluated in terms of the meibomian glands, because it means usually that the stability of the tear film isn't holding up across the day. And then they may need something to help out that, or some treatment of the meibomian glands and an in-office procedure to give them some more longevity across the course of a day. So those things impact my decisions to treat. If you've never expressed meibomian glands before, the most common tool is your finger. You can also use a Q-tip. I like that approach. Sometimes it's easier than touching patient's eye. There are also tools, like we use the meibomian gland expressor that is a little looks like a little USB drive, and it has a little spring to it so that when you press to the end of the spring-loaded component or point, that is the amount of pressure that would be exerted during a blink. And so it's supposed to simulate what you would be expressing normally during a blink. But you can also, you know, then push that a little bit further in and get a bit more expression. It's easiest to start expressing with whatever tool that you choose kind of inferiorly and a little bit towards the nose. Doctors Korb and Blackie demonstrated that that's the area that secretes the most meibum the most of the time. So if you're new to expression, that's a good place to start because you'll get something more quickly. As you get towards the outer, the lateral side of the eye, you see less. I don't know if that's just because they're working less or maybe they're fewer there, but basically that's a harder place to express, although it might be an area where you have more access if you're behind this little lamp. So when I use a Q-tip or my finger, the easiest way to kind of do it is to sort of roll your finger. It's almost like you're milking the glands in a way, and that then helps to sort of encourage it to come from maybe the bottom of the meibomian gland towards the surface and express. And you have to be patient. If you do it for just a second, you're not going to see anything. So you have to kind of hold it, maybe count to yourself 1/1000, 2/1000, and see if you see anything. And then if you don't, maybe move just next door to the next three or four glands with your finger, or, you know, maybe one or two glands with your Q-tip, and kind of see, start there and return back to where you started, because sometimes it's almost like it takes a little bit of time for it to get moving to see something, especially if it's more yucky meibum. So when I look to see the quality of yucky, I guess, I sort of look to see, does it come out quickly and is it clear? And that would be normal. And then if it starts to be opaque, so it's kind of a light yellowish color when it's clear, like cooking oil. And then as it becomes more opaque, it sort of turns like a little bit more yellow. So it's almost like haziness of a hazy yellow color. And then I look to see if you start to see granularity to that, like little dots of stuff in it that make it look a little thicker, but it's still expressible. And it's not the worst scenario, which would be the toothpaste sort of, it just looks like a white squiggle when you push it out. You very rarely see that, even though when we look online at pictures and images, you'll see that a lot of times because it's the, you know, worst thing you can kind of see. But most often you're going to have the haziness of the meibum. And if it's starting to be hazy and you're getting hazy meibum out of several of them, I consider that to be meibomian gland dysfunction and should be treated. Assuming though, you know, you're getting some normal meibum, then you can start with smaller approaches to treatment. There are a number of different grading scales and meibum gradings that are out there. Some of them go from 0 to 4, where 0 is the worst and 4 is the best. Some of them go 0 to 3 that same way, or even flipped. I like to kind of consider that grade 1 is that hazy meibum, grade 2 is the granular meibum, and grade 3 is the toothpaste sign or the very, very thickened secretions. And you may have a point where you either say grade 0 is nothing, or sometimes in some grading scales, grade 4 is that. But the most important thing is that you pick your own and you do it the same way every time. So if you like the idea of normal, cloudy, cloudy with granular, and then toothpaste, that's an easy approach on a 0, 1, 2, and 3 scale.
Thanks for listening to this PERspectives podcast. If you liked today's episode, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening.